The United States has once again backed Israel's devastating military campaign against Palestinians. Palestinian Prime Minister calls for concrete action by the international community to stop Israeli killings in the Gaza Strip. And India reports more than 281,000 new confirmed COVID-19 cases and over 4,100 deaths. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. The U.S. has once again backed Israel's devastating military campaign against Palestinians. The U.S. Secretary of State said the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is to blame for the situation. Anthony Blinken said that he is sorry about the Palestinian loss of lives, but insisted that Israel is entitled to defend itself. Blinken also touched upon Israel's bombing of Gaza Media Tower, saying that they have requested the details from Tel Aviv. Germany also echoed the U.S. support for Israeli attacks on Gaza.
The rocket attacks by Hamas must stop. Germany stands by Israel's side in this situation and by its right to protect its population and to defend itself.
Separately, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel condemned Palestinian rocket attacks in a phone call with the Israeli Prime Minister and expressed solidarity with the regime. Earlier, the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called on Pope Francis to help end what he called Israel's massacre of Palestinians. In a phone call with the pontiff, Erdogan said that Israel must be punished with international sanctions. Meanwhile, Amnesty International blasted Israel for bombing a media tower in Gaza City, saying the attack must be investigated as a war crime. It noted that the strike fits a pattern of Israeli collective punishment of Palestinians. Also, Reporters Without Borders slammed the deliberate bombing of the building as a war crime, accusing Israel of trying to obstruct media coverage of its deadly attacks on the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, several more Palestinians have been killed as Israel presses ahead with its airstrikes and artillery attacks on different parts of the Gaza Strip. The latest fatalities include three in western Gaza, where a car was hit by tank shell. One person was also killed in the city of Jabalia, north of Gaza City. Earlier, Israeli forces targeted a Palestinian government building and a factory. Warplanes also fired dozens of missiles overnight into different parts of the densely populated Palestinian territory. More than 200 Gazans have been killed, nearly 60 of them children, since Israel began pounding the region last Monday. More than 1,200 people have also been injured in Israeli attacks. Palestinian resistance groups have launched fresh rocket attacks on Israel in retaliation for the regime's relentless onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Hamas's military wing said its rockets hit Israeli settlements in Ashdod, injuring at least 8 people. The Zaydin al-Qassam brigades also hit the city of Netivot, as well as a number of military bases. Earlier, an Israeli battleship was hit by Palestinian rockets off the shore of the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, the Islamic Jihad movement said its military wing, Al-Quds Brigades, fired volleys of rockets into the cities of Sderot and Netivot. So far, 10 Israelis have been killed and hundreds injured by Palestinian rocket fire. The Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh has called for more concrete actions from the international community against Israel. Speaking from the city of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank, Shtayyeh said that mere condemnations are not enough anymore. He urged the UN to issue a resolution that describes Israeli actions against the Palestinians as illegal and illegitimate. Shtayyeh said that the crimes Israel has committed against the Palestinians have to be punished by international law. He called for an immediate end to the Israeli onslaught, saying that any delay means the renewal of Israeli killing license against the Palestinians. The Palestinian premier also called upon allies to summon Israeli ambassadors and to halt trade relations with the regime. Yemenis have turned out in their thousands to voice solidarity with Palestinians in the face of Israeli ongoing aggression. Demonstrators in the capital Sana'a chanted slogans in condemnation of Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip. Earlier, a similar rally was held in the northwestern city of Sada'a. Protesters called on the people of Gaza to continue their resistance against Israeli ongoing onslaught. They also expressed their unwavering support for the Palestinian cause. Meanwhile, Yemen's Ansar movement said in a statement that the response from Palestinian resistance fighters has exposed Israel's fragility and weakness. India has reported more than 281,000 new confirmed cases of COVID-19 in just 24 hours. The country has lost more than 4,100 more people to the coronavirus in the same period. The Indian Health Ministry says the number of total fatalities in the country has now surpassed 274,000, and the total caseload is nearing the grim milestone of 25 million. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has sounded the alarm over the rapid spread of the virus across India. The World Health Organization has classified the Indian variant of the COVID-19 as a global concern warning that the second year of the pandemic could be worse than the first. The grim milestone or situation has caused severe shortages of hospital beds and medical and oxygen supplies in the South Asian country. Protesters in the occupied West Bank have taken to the streets to condemn Israeli attacks in the Gaza Strip. We're now joined by our correspondent, Mona Kandil, for more details. Mona, at this point, what do we have for us today? What is the latest on what's going on?
Well, today as well, Palestinian Islamic and national forces have called for a protest in to slam the ongoing Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip and the ongoing killing of innocent people. The protesters have started to gather. They were marching towards the northern entrance of Al Biri and Ramallah cities, where the Israeli military checkpoint of Beit Il and the illegal settlement of Beit Il are located. This area behind us have been witnessing ongoing clashes between the Palestinian protesters and Israeli forces. A number of Palestinians have been wounded, and others have been also killed by the Israeli fire. The Israeli forces in the last few days have been using, in addition to the firing heavy tear gas and stun grenades, as well as the rubber-coated bullets, the Israeli soldiers have been also firing live rounds towards the protesters to disperse them. Even though, and despite the numbers of the casualties, the high numbers of casualties, Palestinians have been insisting to continue their struggle, ordering and demanding that the Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip should stop, that the Israeli illegal practices in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and in the lands occupied in 1948 must come to an end as well. Protests have also been taking place all across the occupied West Bank. Now, tomorrow, Tuesday, the Palestinian movement of Fatah, as well as all the Palestinians, however, have called for a general strike in protest of the ongoing Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip and the forced expulsions from Jerusalem, Al-Quds, specifically the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. So businesses, schools, universities, and offices all across the occupied West Bank would be completely closed, and there would be demonstrations taking place. This general strike in support of another strike had been called inside the lands that were occupied in 1948, where Palestinians there have been facing a difficult escalation and difficult situation with the aggression of the Israeli police there and the settlers as well. This happened at the time the Israeli forces were raiding the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, and they were trying to carry out the forced expulsions of Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Palestinians then have been protesting inside the lands that were occupied in 1948. It seems that the protesters now, maybe you can see, they have started marching towards the Israeli military checkpoint of Beit Il. Scores of Palestinians holding only the Palestinian flags. Palestinians today feel more than any time before it's an urgent need to continue with their unity, to make the unity their priority, especially that they are united in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, in the lands occupied in 1948, in the occupied West Bank, in the Gaza Strip. Palestinians today feel more than any time before that only their unity would be enabling them to stand strong in the face of the illegal practices and the Israeli crimes and massacres being carried out all across the occupied territories.
Taking a look at the protest that you were talking about, I'm wondering why this protest is being held where it is, and if there are, I believe you mentioned there are protests that are happening across the occupied territories. Is tomorrow going to be a day where, if I heard you correctly, that there's going to be a public closure? So I'm guessing that there's going to be more protests. Do you have any information on that?
Yes, that's right. No businesses, no schools or universities, everything would be shut down here in the occupied West Bank. We are speaking only about the medical facilities and hospitals only would be working. It's something also very tough on the Israeli authorities, because it's the first time that the Palestinians themselves are declaring a general strike and protest inside the lands that were occupied in 1948. So the general strike in the occupied West Bank would be also to support the other one taking place in the lands occupied in 1948, where it's known as Israel. This has angered the Israeli regime. We have been receiving statements from Israeli officials that they are not meant to witness chaos inside what's known as Israel. But Palestinians are saying it's not a chaos. It's an attack and assault of the real owners of the land. The Israelis are not meant. They don't want to see the Palestinians resisting wherever they are. At the time, the Israeli police have been giving a green light to the settlers to attack Palestinians, to burn their vehicles as well as the mosques. So that's why Palestinians are saying, are refusing these measures, and that they will continue to defend their land, because at the end of the day, they are Palestinians, the real owners of these lands.
Thank you very much for that. From Alberta, we have our correspondent Mona Kandil giving us the latest there. Mona, thank you so much. At this point, we're going to our other studios to get an update about Iran's presidential elections and all the developments surrounding it with Kisa.
Thank you, Kaveh. Well, Iran's Constitutional Council has held its first meeting to vet presidential hopefuls for next month's election. The council spokesman said that they examined the credentials and other documents submitted by the potential candidates. Abbas Harikat Khodai said the next meeting of the Constitutional Council will be held on Wednesday. The vetting body will release a final list of approved presidential candidates on May 26th and 27th. Nearly 600 people have registered to run for president. The hopefuls include Judiciary Chief Ebrahim Raisi, First Vice President Ishaq Jahangiri, former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, and former Defense Minister Hossein Dehqan. Iran's 13th presidential election will be held on June 18th. Nearly 60 million Iranians are eligible to vote. Well, Iran's first vice president, Ishaq Jahangiri, has registered for the June 18th presidential election. This is the second time that he is running for the executive post. The following report takes a closer look at his profile.
Jahangiri was born in 1958 in Kerman. He holds a PhD in industrial management. Jahangiri began his political career following the 1979 revolution. He became the deputy head of the agriculture department in Kerman in 1980 and was appointed as its head 2 years later. Jahangiri has also served as a member of parliament for 8 years. He was appointed as the governor of Isfahan in September 1992 by then President Akbar Hoshemi Rafsanjani and held the position until 1997, when he was nominated by then President Mohammad Khatami as the Minister of Mines and Metals and was confirmed by the parliament. His portfolio was later changed to the Minister of Industries and Mines. Jahangiri is the co-founder of Executive Construction Party and served as its Secretary General from 2006 to 2010. In 2013, after Hassan Rouhani won the presidential election, Jahangiri was appointed as the first vice president. He was nominated for the 2017 presidential election, but withdrew in the final days of campaigning and endorsed Rouhani. Later, after Rouhani won the election, Jahangiri was reappointed as first vice president. On May 15, Jahangiri registered to run for president. He called for a huge turnout in the vote to overcome the problems the country is facing.
Iran has been facing hardship in many areas during the past few years. It needs to open new horizons in people's lives. We need to expand the country's capabilities in all aspects. We need to improve the people's lives by removing the sanctions and achieving a stable economic growth and fair distribution of wealth. The elections have to be considered an opportunity based on the Islamic Revolution's values. The presidential election is around the corner, an election for everyone to take part.
The first vice president described his ideal government as an entity at the service of the people. He said a practical government should respond to people's demands and act transparently. As a president, Jahangiri said he would pick honest people for his cabinet and resolutely fight any forms of corruption inside his administration.
Now, Iran's judiciary chief, Ebrahim Raisi, has officially declared his bid for presidency more than a month ahead of the elections in Iran. The following report takes a closer look at his profile and the posts that he has held over the past years.
Sayyid Ebrahim Raisi is a prominent Iranian cleric who was born in 1960. He has held several key posts in the judiciary branch since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, serving as the prosecutor of the cities of Karaj and Hamadan, as well as the capital Tehran. In 1994, Raisi was appointed as the head of General Inspection Office. He also served as first Deputy Chief of Justice of Iran and the Attorney General of the country. In March 2016, Raisi became the chairman of Astan Quds Razavi. That's an umbrella administrative organization managing the holy shrine of the 8th Shia Imam in Mashhad and several other institutions. In March 2019, Raisi was appointed as the judiciary chief, a post he currently serves. Raisi is also an incumbent member of the Assembly of Experts. He has now announced that he will join the race for the June presidential election in Iran. Raisi registered for the election on May 15th and said he's running as an independent under the slogan of fighting corruption.
I see myself as the rival to corruption, inefficiency, and aristocracy. I'm not a rival to political factions and this or that group. I'm the rival of inefficiency.
Raisi says he wants to participate in the presidential poll because of public demand and has pledged change in managing the country's affairs. Raisi ran for president in the previous election in 2017, when he gained 38% of the vote. He ranked second behind incumbent president Hassan Rouhani.
Well, Kaveh, that was the latest on the Iranian presidential election. We'll be bringing you more updates on this new segment every single day.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
To understand the roots of the current escalation and the possible threat of all-out war, one must examine the U.S.-backed foundational Israeli regime policy of using strategies of terror and expulsion in an effort to expand its territory by killing and displacing Palestinians, says Noam Chomsky, American linguist, philosopher and political activist, in an exclusive interview for Truth Out. This interview is published under the heading, Chomsky says, without USAID, Israel wouldn't be killing Palestinians en masse. Stay tuned for more. I want to start by asking you to put into context the Israeli regime attack against Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque amid eviction protests. What's new? What's old? And to what extent is this latest round of neo-colonial Israeli violence related to Trump's move of the U.S. embassy to Al-Quds?
There are always new twists, but in essentials it is an old story, tracing back a century, taking new forms after Israeli regime's 1967 conquest and a decision 50 years ago by both major political groupings to choose expansion over security and diplomatic settlement. Anticipating and receiving crucial US material and diplomatic support all the way. For what became the dominant tendency in the Zionist movement, there has been a fixed long-term goal. Put crudely, the goal is to rid the country of Palestinians and replace them with Jewish settlers, cast as the rightful owners of the land, returning home after millennia of exile. At the outset, the British, then in charge, generally regarded this project as just. Lord Balfour, author of the declaration granting Jews a national home in Palestine, captured Western elite ethical judgment fairly well by declaring that Zionism, be it right or wrong, good or bad, is rooted in age-long tradition, in present needs, in future hopes, of far profounder import than the desires and prejudices of 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land. The sentiments are not unfamiliar. Zionist policies since have been opportunistic. When possible, the Israeli regime, and indeed the entire Zionist movement, adopt strategies of terror and expulsion. When circumstances don't allow that, it uses softer means. A century ago, the device was to quietly set up a watchtower and a fence, and soon it will turn into a settlement, facts on the ground. The counterpart today is the Israeli regime expelling even more Palestinian families from the homes where they have been living for generations. Will a gesture towards legality to salve the conscience of those derided in Israel as beautiful souls. Of course, the mostly absurd legalistic pretenses for expelling Palestinians are 100% racist. There is no thought of granting Palestinian rights to return to homes from which they've been expelled, even rights to build on what's left to them. Israel's 1967 conquest made it possible to extend similar measures to the conquered territories, in this case in gross violation of international laws, as Israeli leaders were informed right away by their highest legal authorities. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime settled and annexed the Golan Heights in violation of the United Nations Security Council orders, as it did in Jerusalem. The Gaza horror story is too complex to recount here. It is one of the worst of contemporary crimes, shrouded in a dense network of deceit and apologetics for atrocities. Donald Trump went beyond his predecessors in providing free rein for Israeli crimes. One major contribution was orchestrating the Abraham Accords, which formalized long-standing tacit agreement between Israel and several Arab dictatorships that relieved limited Arab restraints on Israeli violence and expansion. The Abraham Accords fulfill another Trump objective, bringing under Washington's umbrella the major resources areas needed to accelerate the race towards environmental cataclysm, the cause to which Donald Trump and associates dedicated themselves with impressive fervor. It is of some interest that the formalization of the alliance of some of the world's most violent, repressive and reactionary states has been greatly applauded across a broad spectrum of opinion. So far, Joe Biden has taken over these programs. He has rescinded the gratuitous brutality of Trumpism, such as withdrawing the fragile lifeline for Gaza, because, as Donald Trump explained, Palestinians had not been grateful enough for his demolition of their just aspirations. Otherwise, the Trump-Kushner criminal edifice remains intact, though some specialists on the region think it might totter with repeated Israeli regime attacks on Palestinian worshippers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque and other exercises of Israel's effective monopoly of violence.
Israeli regime settlements have no legal validity, so why is the U.S. continuing to provide aid to the Israeli regime in violation of U.S. law, and why isn't the progressive community focusing on this illegality?
U.S. governments have always had a cavalier attitude to U.S. law, adhering to standard imperial practice. Take what is arguably the major example. The U.S. Constitution declares that treaties entered into by the U.S. government are the supreme law of the land. The major post-war treaty is the United Nations Charter, which bars the threat or use of force in international affairs, with exceptions that are not relevant in real cases. Can you think of a president who hasn't violated this provision of the supreme law of the land with abandon? The substantial Israeli regime nuclear arsenal should, under America's laws, raise serious questions about the legality of military and economic aid to the Israeli regime. That difficulty is overcome by not recognizing its existence, an unconcealed farce and a highly consequential one. As we've discussed elsewhere, U.S. military aid to the Israeli regime also violates the Lehi Law, which bans military aid to units engaged in systematic human rights violations. The Israeli regime armed forces provide many candidates. Congresswoman Betty McCollum has taken the lead in pursuing this initiative. Carrying it further should be a prime commitment for those concerned with U.S. support for the terrible Israeli regime crimes against Palestinians. Even a threat to the huge flow of aid could have a dramatic impact.
The subcontinent.
Hi everyone, this is Don, and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Since now I'll be taking a long leave, I would like you to meet our new host, Mr. Mehdi Gulzadeh.
Thank you, John. Well, as he said, I'm Mehdi Gulzadeh. From now on, I'll be doing the rest of the episodes. Our episodes aim at to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
Please stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at the deadly surge of the second wave of the COVID pandemic in India. Then we will explore how the Indian government has managed the catastrophe so far and its plans to stop the spread across the subcontinent.
Before we delve into our main story on the coronavirus pandemic in India, let's talk about another tragedy that has been plaguing the globe, Takfiri terrorism.
A car bomb was detonated across a school in the neighborhood of Adashtel Barchi, and when students rushed out in panic, two more bombs exploded. The neighborhood is home to a large community of Shias from the Hazara ethnic minority, which has been often targeted by the extremists. More than 80 people were killed and about 150 more injured in the Saturday attack.
Teenage girls in Afghanistan are torn between fears and ambitions. Fear from the rising Takfiri presence in their country and ambitions of education and freedom. Being a schoolgirl in Afghanistan was already difficult, as they had to study in tattered tents or the open air, and the schools were desperately overcrowded without essential facilities such as toilets. But the hardships and threats they face outside school may change or even end their lives forever.
Indians are suffering from a devastating wave of pandemic like no country has ever experienced. Yes, it is true that the size of the population of the country makes it an arduous task to contain an epidemic of this magnitude. But the government's negligence about this second wave is taking a heavy toll on the people. My co-host Mehdi will walk you through some of the frightening figures.
The recent rise in the number of COVID cases has registered a peak in almost all the charts by the relevant authorities. India has recorded over 23 million cases of COVID, while the death toll is about 250,000. The weekly number of infections has averaged a record of over 390,000, while the country's daily coronavirus cases rose by 330,000, accounting for one in every three deaths reported worldwide each day.
The deadly surge in India's COVID cases has overwhelmed the subcontinent, and it may even grow to a global disaster. This second wave of the pandemic is larger and spreading more rapidly than the last one, and is also affecting more people across age groups, including children and infants. Since the start of April, daily infections have been soaring. People are gasping to stay alive as they wait for critical care beds and treatment. In addition to families, the increasing rise in infections has placed an enormous strain on health and critical care facilities. Hospitals cannot handle the load, and families are scrambled for scarce medicines and oxygen cylinders or a doctor's appointment. In many cities, mass funeral pyres and cremations never stop in the parking lots that have been turned into crematoriums to accommodate the rising number of the dead. Dozens of bodies wash up on the banks of rivers every day, while the locals complain about the authorities' inaction to control the unbearable smell.
It is not hidden, the fact that it's pretty out of control, especially last week. Now it looks a little bit under control this week and past 2 days. So if I analyze why it went out, probably there are multiple factors. One factor is related with the people, means people were little bit complacent. They got vaccination, including healthcare worker. We thought that, okay, everybody was tired of mask. Everybody is tired of, not having, to get together with each other. So a human is a social person, isn't it? They try to find out the way to meet each other. So they started meeting. They thought that pandemic and now this virus is not going to come again. And even if it's come and we are vaccinated, especially high-risk population got vaccinated. So one is that complacency from the people side. Second, they were, election rallies. They were farmer rallies. So probably people also thought, got a message that even at the highest level, probably this is not going to come. Thirdly, of course, it looks like some complacency from other like government agencies, and so nobody expected.
The World Health Organization has said that the variant of the COVID-19 behind the acceleration of India's explosive outbreak has been found in dozens of countries, not only in the subcontinent, but all over the world. According to the UN Health Agency, the B.1.617 variant had been detected in more than 4,500 samples uploaded to an open access database from 44 countries in all six regions of WHO. Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Nepal are India's neighbors worst hit by the double mutant, while the UK had reported the largest number of COVID cases caused by the variant.
Lancet Medical Journal has said Modi's government should be held responsible for presiding over a self-inflicted national catastrophe. According to an estimate by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, that is an independent global health research center of the University of Washington, the deaths could potentially reach a staggering 1 million by August this year.
In the early days of 2021, India seemed to be on the path to normalcy when the daily positive cases were reported less than 10,000, the lowest in about 8 to 10 months. Vaccinations had started and hospitalization had decreased. India then started to open up and ease restrictions while the virus was evolving and mutating. Many research centers and organizations had predicted the second wave, but they did not know about the severity and when it would hit the country. But the government decided to ignore that. The Indian government's handling of the pandemic has created public uproar, while many in the world have pinned the blame on Prime Minister Modi for the new wave because he had ignored many warnings about the looming catastrophe. In early March, a forum of scientific advisers set up by the Modi administration had issued stern warnings of a new and more contagious variant taking hold in the country. This was after a parliamentary committee had warned of a shortage of oxygen in the coming months. Despite the warnings, the federal government did not seek to impose major restrictions to contain the spread of the virus. Some critics say arrogance, hyper-nationalism and bureaucratic incompetence have combined to create a crisis of epic proportions as the government allowed religious gatherings and political rallies regardless of the facts. Millions of people, largely unmasked, attended election rallies for the 2021 assembly election that were held by Modi, leaders of the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party and opposition politicians. The other super spreader event was Kumbh Mela, a major pilgrimage and festival in Hinduism. Millions of devotees took part in the gathering without any form of social distancing. The pilgrims then went back to their home states and catapulted the contagion.
This wave is different from the previous wave, and it is not only infectiousness, but the severity of infection is very high. So we are able to grasp the use of steroid in particular window that has helped us in decreasing the oxygen requirement in the patients. So everybody has learned over past 2 weeks, including government, including public, and including physicians and clinicians, and also people have started vaccinating themselves, and probably it may not help in this way, but of course we may be able to revert the third wave, which somebody projected that may come.
India is the world's biggest producer of COVID vaccines, but shortages of the shots in some states have hindered the opening of inoculations for all adults. Some people say the shortage is because India exported about 60 million doses to 70 countries, but some experts believe the problem goes deeper. India produces over 2.5 million doses of vaccines every day. Even if it manages to vaccinate more than 2 million people per day, the nationwide vaccination will take over 2 years. Moreover, dozens of countries are sending large shipments of oxygen products to India, but the virus-hit country lacks the necessary means to distribute them to the people in need. Adding to the misery, there are also reports of deaths in people who had received both doses of their vaccines. The Indian double mutant may need new or moderated vaccine formulas.
If we look at the real-time experience of past 1 month, what I can say with some surety that those people who were vaccinated by Covishield actually didn't land up in major severe pneumonia. Now, when we talk about this is a very generalized statement. It has to have a lot of exceptions. Now, look at the modern, look at the other vaccines like Pfizer and Moderna. They also had 5,800 infections. Though there were not many much mutation, but without mutation, there were so many breakthrough infections. So it's very hard to say that those vaccines can prevent mutation more effectively than Covishield. One, it's a time will tell. Second, at times the studies which are done in, you know, at a vitro level, at a vivo level, in a very small group of people, the studies being done, they were done when we didn't have so much mutation. So if you look at the efficacy of Moderna and Pfizer as compared to newer vaccine like Novavax and Johnson, leave aside Covishield, these efficiencies of 90-95% were there when we had original Wuhan strain. Now, they have not been time tested with these type of triple mutation, double mutation, and which evades immunity. One. So one is not very sure, but since we haven't seen them, they haven't tested, so we feel that, okay, they may work, because we are humans, we always feel that there is some hope. So I think we need more studies, and if this type of infection unfortunately strikes the places where people have been fully vaccinated by Pfizer and Moderna, then we'll come to know actual ground situation.
India spends only about 3% of its GDP on healthcare. The country is in serious need of infrastructure. The third wave of the pandemic is coming while the Indian variants have been spreading to the neighboring countries. If not contained, the Indian pandemic may be able to further deepen the global plague.
Listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Tina Thacker, assistant editor of the Economic Times. Now, Tina, why did the pandemic get out of hand in India?
So right now we are seeing a massive lethal wave of COVID virus in the country. We have variants which are circulating in India, but the variants could not be blamed for the dramatic surge in cases and deaths seen in India. The country appeared to have let its guard down with huge social mixing and large gatherings. India felt that the crisis was over, dropping mask wearing and other protection measures, but the virus was quietly spreading. So here we are, we have seen big election rallies happening, and we have also seen religious, this festival where we saw huge gatherings, and this has all led to the situation, I would say.
How is the government handling the situation, and what grade do you give the Modi government?
That's a really sad part, that we are not just seeing COVID cases, but people have been dying due to inadequate supplies of oxygen, medicines, something which is as you know, as basic as a hospital bed. People are not getting hospital beds, so the health infrastructure is actually crumbling, which is a really sad part and shows the sad state of affairs. You know, instead of government, Twitter has become the new helpline where strangers are helping each other, getting medicines, getting beds. So I think government is doing its bit, but probably that's not enough, and the situation has got out of hand.
What can it do to reduce the severity of the disaster? Basically, what can we hope for?
You know, so we have inoculated just about like less than 2% of the population right now. And given the size of the country, it's a Herculean task. Then there's a shortage of vaccines. We don't have enough supplies. We have only two companies which are supplying vaccines to the country. Although we expect more companies to get approval in days to come, we can hope for maybe, you know, importing vaccines from other countries, like, you know, for instance, US, which is not using the AstraZeneca vaccine. The supplies can be diverted to India. Then we have J&J, where people are hesitant to, you know, take J&J, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So that's the only silver lining that we see right now to get enough people getting vaccinated.
Who are the most hit in India, and what can be done for them?
We have to keep just, keep updating with the testing. We are not testing enough. We don't know if the testing has reached to the rural areas. So, and this time around, what we've seen is that the virus has impacted more young people, which is also in the productive age group, getting impacted because of the virus. So we have to at least ensure that the basic medical care is provided to them, at least to the people.
Tina, we'll give you a break so we can see media and cyberspace.
Viruses mutate all the time, producing different versions or variants of themselves. Most of these mutations are significant, and some may even make the virus less dangerous. But others can make it more contagious and harder to vaccinate against. This variant, officially known as B.1.617, was first detected in India in October. Researchers in India are now trying to pinpoint what is behind the unprecedented surge, which could be due to an unfortunate confluence of factors, including the emergence of particularly infectious variants, a rise in unrestricted social interactions, and low vaccine coverage. Untangling the causes could be helpful to governments trying to suppress or prevent similar surges around the world. India's laboratories are struggling to keep up with the punishing COVID-19 surge as its scientists try to track and understand new coronavirus mutations. The World Health Organization has classified a variant first identified in India, known as B.1.617, as a variant of concern, saying preliminary studies suggested it may be more contagious than other variants. The WHO scientists didn't report any evidence that vaccines aren't effective against the new variant. India is in the process of ramping up its capacity to do genomic sequencing to track changes in the virus's genetic makeup by examining positive test samples. While experts suggest that the mortality rate in the second wave is similar to last year's wave, data shared by the Indian government clearly shows that the ratio of young adults in the 30 to 40 age group dying of the disease is higher than the first wave. This means there are more young children losing their parents, and some have been left totally alone as their entire immediate family has succumbed to the virus.
Tina, thank you for the wait. And now India's neighbors are already reporting cases of the Indian version. How long does it take for the wave to spread throughout the globe, and what happens then?
You know, so the variants have arisen in various parts of the world, including the British variant, which is the UK variant, which first entered in India, and we still have it. Now we have variants traveling abroad from India. We have South African variant, which has traveled to some places. So everybody has to keep a watch out for them. The main protection against them is only two things. Prevent spreading by masking and by avoiding super spreading events. And second is to just, you know, ramp up vaccinations so that people don't get seriously ill. That's what we can do right now.
Now, Tina, considering the large size and population of the country, is nationwide vaccination even possible? What is a feasible scenario? How long does it take and how much vaccines are needed?
Yeah. So, you know, India is a vast country, but definitely it is possible. It will take a long time because we have shortage of vaccines. So ideally, if you have plenty of vaccines available, you could go down to people as young as 18 years. But now that India has announced that they're going to vaccinate people who are above 18 plus, it's going to take some time because there are not enough vaccine supplies. So we have to just make sure that we have to protect our 45 plus population, because they are the ones who are most vulnerable. And maybe look at younger people with comorbidities. But we have to just use that rationing and triaging as long as we have got limited supplies of vaccines.
And one last question, how can the international community help the situation?
You know, as of now, we are getting a lot of foreign aid. A lot of countries have helped India in getting oxygen concentrators, medicines. So we have a lot of foreign aid coming in to India, which has really helped. India has been leading a push from lower and middle income countries at the World Trade Organization to do away patents on vaccines. So we'll have to see how other countries react to the same, faced with this possibility of losing out on their profit margins and monopoly. We are hopeful now that the US has supported it. So we may see this coming, which would mean not immediately, but maybe in the long run, we'll see more vaccines coming in, and it will be cheaper as well. So that's the silver lining that I see now.
Tina, thank you for your precious time, and we'd love to have you back on the program again. Now let's see how the people have reacted on social media and the cyberspace.
This account, named When the Flame Turns Blue, believes the Indian pandemic is now a global concern. Rojana Punjab has appreciated the Indian Navy's efforts to bring the much-needed oxygen tanks from abroad. Akanksha Sharma has reflected concerns by an Indian blogger about the country's mismanagement of the pandemic before he succumbed to the disease. Niyati Bava has tweeted about an indigenous drug that may help in oxygen regulation in COVID patients.
All right, so that was our episode covering the second wave of the COVID pandemic in India. This was also my last episode as the host of this show, and I must say it has been an honor serving you for all this time. My colleague Mehdi now will carry the torch in our upcoming programs. On to Mehdi.
Thank you, John. We will meet again next week.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BADR 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.